Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, of course, and it is July 5th, 2016. Well, you know, here we are. We're just a couple of weeks post the infamous Brexit vote, which is still reverberating around the financial and political worlds. Now, in prior times, such a thing as the UK detangling itself somewhat economically and politically from the rest of the EU would not be sending such massive shockwaves through the system. But today, that's happening. And the reasons why are numerous and themselves all tangled up with each other. Now, this is a very important podcast in our series because it's entirely possible that ill-advised era of central bank meddling is coming to an ugly end and a new regime is about to take over. If so, literally everything is up for grabs and nothing is certain. So you should really listen to this one carefully. And I am beyond delighted to have back on the show one of the very best, and I mean that, thinkers and observers in the business. To help us find the signal in a choppy sea of noise is Grant Williams, who has, to his own amazement and chagrin, I hear, 30 years of experience in investing and finance, and who writes the very popular investment newsletter, Things That Make You Go Hmm, of which I'm a huge and unabashed fan. His writing is always witty, full of context, accurate, easy to follow. Welcome, Grant. Real pleasure to have you back today.
Oh, Chris, thank you. It's always a thrill to chat with you.
Well, thanks. Well, I want to start with Brexit, obviously. It caught me by surprise, mainly because there have been very few cases in my lifetime where the ruling elite did not get their way, and they clearly wanted Remain to win the day. Didn't happen. So it's sending shockwaves. Are these shockwaves deserved, undeserved? Was this just a case of a bubble seeking a pin, and that pin was Brexit? Or is there something that we really should worry about here?
I think the shockwaves are deserved, but perhaps not for the reasons that most people would expect. I think you put it so beautifully in your introduction there, in terms of this era of or what Ben Hunt calls the golden era of the central bank is coming to an end. And I think that is potentially the real shockwave here. And I wasn't as surprised as many people that this Brexit vote happened. And I wrote a piece about this in February, I think. Yeah, the Brits have a long history of A, not liking being told what to do by outside observers, and B, voting for things and doing things that perhaps other people would think may not be in their best interest. We have a history of that. So I think there's one chart that is absolutely fascinating. If you look at the polls for people to remain or leave going into the moment where Barack Obama threw his hat in the ring and told the Brits that they'd be foolish to leave the EU and how we go to the back of the line for a trade deal. From that day, the support to leave skyrocketed, which was fascinating to me. And I think the establishment underestimated the damage being done by bringing more outside observers, Barack Obama, Angela Merkel, Christine Lagarde. They all weighed in on why, you know, you Brits would be foolish to leave. And it just put British backs up. And I think that the debate, unfortunately, was dominated on the Remain side by economic fear-mongering, and on the Leave side, to a large extent, by the immigration issue. And I suspect it was the immigration issue that probably won the day, looking at the parts of the country that voted strongly to leave. And I think what people will see in the long term is that Britain made the right decision, arguably at the time for the wrong reasons. And I think in the long term, it's going to be a positive for Britain, because I think the EU in its present form certainly is finished, and it's going through the motions of its death knell now. And if the British leaving is a catalyst for change in the EU, then I think it's unreservedly a good thing.
Now, the EU being finished because it was a quasi-political union and monetary union without full taxation, so it was just structurally wrong? Or is there just something about what happens when you try and get that many bureaucrats together to try and do something? Is it just, you know, is it too many cats to herd? Is that the issue? Or what do you mean by saying that the EU is finished here?
It was a noble cause at the outset, and it morphed into something far, far greater. The reach extended way too far into national culture and national identity. And to have a monetary and increasingly political union without a fiscal union was never going to work in times of stress. And we've seen that since the dark days of 08, 09, and particularly in Europe, 2011, 12, when really until Draghi's whatever it takes speech, the entire project was hanging by a thread. It was unsustainable. And what they've had to do to keep it together goes beyond the realms of normal central bank remit. And it's increasingly unsustainable. There hasn't been a single proactive policy out of a central bank in 10, some would say 20 years. And so they're constantly reacting to the last crisis and the next crisis and putting measures in place that no right-thinking person would actually look at when they were trying to establish a structure like this. And so as the Brexit vote goes through, we're looking at potential votes in places like Holland, Austria, Finland, where there's strong anti-EU sentiment. The big problem is going to be France, where the disapproval rate of the EU now runs into the 60% level. And the dissatisfaction, which I think is why you're seeing a lot of talk out of the EU about how tough this is going to be on Britain. They have to kind of make an example of Britain. In a normal world, you would expect adults that each want to do a good trade deal to sit around a table. But the idea of the Brits being punished for leaving this tells you they are worried about the Brits leaving and it not being a disaster, because that would send signals to the Dutch and the Finns and the Austrians that, hey, you know what, being out on your own with your own currency and a trade deal might not be the worst thing in the world. So if you look at Italy, there's a referendum coming up in Italy, which is going to be held no later than October. And it's a purely domestic referendum, but it is a chance for the people to speak. And one can infer from what's happened in Britain that the old saw about people don't actually vote for the issue they're being asked about, they vote for the state of their lives. It's going to be a very interesting thing, because if he loses, the Prime Minister has already said that he would step down. So there is another vacuum with the Five Star Party in Italy being very, very strong with the public at the moment on an anti-EU exit the EU and get rid of the euro and go back to the lira platform. So there are myriad things that can go wrong for the EU. And the Brexit vote looks to me like it will not only be the catalyst for that, but a convenient thing to blame all around the world for the Fed not being able to hike rates, for example. They're going to blame that on Brexit. They will blame further disruption in the EU on Brexit. And I think that's wholly unfair. I think Brexit is a catalyst, not part of the problem.
Now, I love how you said that maybe Brexit was the right vote at the right time for the wrong reasons. I'll tell you, so immigration, I can see both sides of the issue, very complex. One trend that I don't think is that hard to understand is that with all of the globalization, with the centralization, what has inarguably happened, and of course, you know, you and I wrote about this long ago, that when you print lots and lots of money and shove it into the financial system, you will almost by definition create a massive gap in wealth disparity between, you know, the ultra wealthy and everybody else. Those with first access to the trough with their noses in there do better. And that's just not hard to understand. That the Fed's professed ignorance as to how this all arose, but it's not that hard to understand. So I think it's false ignorance. But could we not see Brexit as really part of that was a referendum of people saying, we're just unhappy with the direction things are going. You know, my common average life is not getting better. It's getting harder. And you guys at the top seem to be a little tone deaf to that trajectory. Let's stop this while we can.
Absolutely. And the evidence is so clear. If you look at the electoral map of the UK, you just need one look at that. What you'll find is Scotland voted to remain, and Scotland feels far more part of the EU than it does of the UK, as we saw in the referendum, you know, fairly close referendum where they tried to leave. Northern Ireland, again, a province, if you like, of Great Britain. But then if you look at the map of England, which I did in a recent piece I wrote, I took those two out of the equation, you see the Leave vote blanketing the country, and the only obvious places where there was strong support for Remain are, guess what, where those wealthy people live. It was central London and the places around London, and it was the home counties, you know, Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire, where a lot of those people live. So it was a clear vote between the haves and the have-nots. The have-nots, who, going back to my earlier point about the referendum in Italy, are unhappy with their lot, with the status quo, and the people that have the assets, have the money, who are very happy for things to carry on. I mean, it was such a clear picture of the vote and why it happened. I really don't think you need to look at anything else to understand it, frankly.
Well, excellent. Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Now, Italy, this is going to be fascinating, that this vote coming up, because I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal, and finally, Italian banks have hit the front pages here in the United States. Although you and I discussed this last year, and how could we not have? I mean, 18% non-performing loan ratio means their entire banking system is utterly insolvent, to the tunes of hundreds of billions of euros, while the stabilization fund they put up, what, maybe 5 billion euros, if I have my numbers right, woefully not up to the task. And the Italian government really can't step in for a variety of reasons here. And I'm sure they're peeking over the border, checking out what happened with Greece and the austerity and how the EU's handled all of that. It seems to me that there's an extraordinary systemic risk here just in the Italian banking system alone. Would you agree with that? And should investors maybe be thinking about that a little more carefully?
I agree, absolutely. But I would extend it to the entire European banking system. You have to look at the charts of these banks to really understand what's going on here. And people, the banking system was the center of the epicenter of the crisis in 08. And the narrative has been ever since, well, you know, we've got the banks in order, we've fixed that, we've put stress tests in place, Basel III is coming in, the banking system's fine. Well, you one look at the charts of Deutsche Bank, for example, which is arguably the biggest systemic risk on the face of the planet, the equity is telling you something there. It's telling you that it's going to zero. And if you look at Credit Suisse, look at UBS, you know, these are banking giants in Europe. They are all looking really, really sick. And then you get to Italy, and it's really worrying. And to my point earlier on about reacting to the last crisis, you know, we saw in Cyprus, when we had the crisis in Cyprus, the response to that was the bail-in rules. And at the time, again, it was something that I don't think people understood what happened there. I mean, depositors had money confiscated by the government to pay for rescuing the banking system. Now, those rules are now in place across Europe. Well, ironically, the problems being seen now in the Italian banking system are hampered by the bail-in rules. So the rules they put in for the last crisis mean that the Italians can't step in and save their banking system unless they find a way to change these rules again. So, you know, putting a Band-Aid over these things every time they happen only lasts for so long. And I think ultimately this comes back to your point at the very start of this conversation about this confidence in central bankers, which is so important. I mean, I can't stress how important it is to maintain that. And it's weakening by the day. And so the Italian banking system is the canary in the coal mine. The numbers are just, I mean, head-scratchingly ridiculous, frankly. I mean, the $5 billion they put into the Atlanta fund to bail out the banks, which was rather cutely named after Atlas, because the idea was that this fund would hold the sky up and stop it falling on Italian banks. Well, they blew through half of the capital in the first 6 weeks this thing was in operation. And now they're talking about another $40 billion needed to be thrown into the Italian banking system to save it. Now, these are real numbers, or they used to be. We talk in trillions now, and so people think, oh, $40 billion, that's not so much money, right? It's real money. It adds up. And the fact that these guys are largely hamstrung by their own prior actions is at some point going to matter. And we will have another crisis in the European banking system again. It's coming. You can see it.
Well, Grant, if you just take that $40 billion and you match it up against the stated value of the non-performing loans, and let me guess perhaps that there are some bankers in Italy that are, let's say, incentivized to underreport that number, right? Just the $40 billion against the reported non-performing loans is 8%. So that's saying we're going to get a 92% recovery rate on these, or that's all the capital we need to make these work again. Clearly, that's not sufficient. So even that number, as large as it is insufficient. Where would they get even $40 billion, but where would they get more than that in the current climate?
Well, funnily enough, you asked that the next tranche of this they're talking about co-opting money from the pension funds into it to try and find the capital to try and bail these things out. I mean, it's you can't make this stuff up. There was a piece written by a good friend of mine, Danielle DiMartino Booth, recently. Your listeners can Google it, called The Italian Job. And she looked at the numbers here. And, you know, the non-performing loans, there's a total, she came up with 408 billion euros of non-performing loans on the bank balance sheet in Italy. Now, investors think that unsecured, they're worth about 5 cents on the dollar, and secured, they'd be worth somewhere between 25 and 35 cents on the dollar. They're marked on bank balance sheets at between 50 and 65 cents on the dollar. So, you know, the gap there is unbridgeable, essentially, without who knows how much money. And that 408 billion euros of non-performing loans is 20%, not of the bank's market caps, but of Italian GDP.
Wow.
So we are talking numbers here that are unworkable without the suspension of belief and a serious change in the rules and some more whatever it takes by central banks. So, you know, it's coming. It's going to have to happen at some point. And when it does, the only real question is, do the pigs get greedy again and stick their nose in the trough because they have that central bank backstop? Or does a little bit of reality return and people say, you know, you said whatever it takes last time. Here we are again. We don't believe you anymore. And it's at that point when I think this whole thing crumbles.
Now, this is, I think, the center of the entire discussion, which is that we... We're down the rabbit hole at this point. We're in this faith-based model at this point in time. And really investing, double air quotes around that word today, seems to boil down to how much are you willing to suspend that belief, how much disbelief, how much are you willing to ignore fundamentals and believe that the central banks have your back? Well, apparently that's a big part of the equation, if not the dominant part at this stage. So this central belief in the central bankers is really all important. Here's my question. I hardly even know how to phrase it. Whenever I talk to somebody who's been in the business for a while, Grant, I can't find anybody who really believes in the central bank. I haven't found that diehard person who's willing to say, oh, they've totally got our backs. They will pull us through. Everybody's nervous about this. Who's really, do you think, holding on to this belief that seems to be holding the markets up? Who's the carrier of that torch?
Well, look, I mean, there are, you've got a bunch of people who are essentially paid to believe them. You know, the guys who invest assets, whether it be in mutual funds or pension funds, they've been forced now into equity markets because they've been willing to accept capital gain as a substitute for income in the bond markets for the last few years. That's coming to an end. You know, we've reached negative rates now. So you can argue that we could go further negative, but realistically, the upside for rates is unlimited. The downside, there is a limit on it. And so as they've reached that point and they're being forced to move into the equity market where there is some semblance of a return, the danger to me has become one of liquidity. And as I keep saying to people when I talk about this, in a rising market, you know, I will always find you an offer. If you want to buy shares in a rising market, there is always some for sale. I don't know what the price may be. Maybe it's a little bit higher. People get greedy. But there is always stock for sale. What people have forgotten since 08, which was such a sharp wake-up call, is in really falling markets, there are sometimes no bids. And every flash crash that we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years has been a preview of what's going to happen when confidence goes, because people will move to the exits and everything that's been done, again, we come back to these rules that are put in place to deflect the last crisis. You know, Dodd-Frank, Basel III, banks being forced not to make markets anymore. We will see all the unintended consequences of these actions come out when people want to hit a bid and there isn't a bid there. And it could get ugly. You know, this is for investors. This is, I said to someone today, this is not a time for panic, but it's absolutely a time for a great deal of caution. And you need to understand, A, why you're still invested in markets, and B, what your plan is to get out of them if you suffer a shock. Because if a shock comes and we get a move down like we did in January, February, and it's one that coincides with a whole-scale and widespread loss of confidence in central banks, they're not going to be able to turn this thing around. And people need to have a plan at that point.
Now, you've had some fantastic interviews on Real Vision TV, and I want to talk about one with Kyle Bass, because it's aligned with this point you're making. I thought he made some really great points in that interview, one of which was that if we really want to understand things today, we do well to put the numbers and the financial analysis aside and turn towards psychology and particularly understanding belief systems. So let me preface this question by revealing my personal disbelief system. I can't believe that we are this fully down the bubble rabbit hole again so soon, but here we are. So it seems to me that people are making the same mistakes all over again. It seemed Kyle was making that point. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, look, I do. I mean, Kyle is a brilliant guy, and you know, just humble and nice. It's a treat to talk to the guys. I mean, you get to talk to these guys. Well, you know, it's a real thrill to be able to pick the brains of guys like that. And I think the problem to me is that behavior is, right the way through our lives, is reinforced by consequences. And what's happened since 2008 is everything possible has been done to avoid the consequences. Mm. So it's no great surprise to me, to be honest, that investors are back here again so soon, because you know, what should have happened in 2008, 2009 wasn't allowed to run its course. And while it was frightening at the time, the speed with which trillions of dollars of printed money brought things back to where they were before, people didn't really feel the consequences. At the time, you know, people lost jobs, and that's real, you know, still going on. That problem is still working itself out. But in the markets, investors were basically backstopped by governments and central banks. And so they didn't feel those consequences. You know, it's like the kid falling out the tree and being caught. Well, he's going to climb the tree again. If he fell out and broke his leg, he's going to think twice about it. And so, again, you know, the Band-Aids put over the first problem without really addressing the cause of it, which was way too much debt in the world. What have we done? We've gone out and added another $60, $70 trillion of debt onto the amount that caused the problems in LA. So, you know, everything that's been done is to stave off an outbreak of reality. And unfortunately, history is replete with examples of the outcome eventually making itself known. And there's really not much you can do to stop natural cyclical forces. You may be able to suspend them for a time, which is what they've done, but ultimately they end up expressing themselves in ways and places that are far more dangerous than they were at the time.
Now, this seems fairly obvious to me, and you make it sound so completely obvious as well. I get the sense from listening to, Janet Yellen or any other central banker that they just don't seem to get this part of it. Is this, it feels a little bit like, listen, I have a lot of education in my background, was even on the professor track for a while. I understand academics well. It's been one of my chief critiques of the Federal Reserve is that it's staffed with academics and lawyers, two very, you know, unique and wonderful specialties, but they have a worldview that I don't share. When I look at the broader view of things, of course, I include resources in this story. I'm looking at demographic trends. I'm thinking about things beyond, you know, little growth equations and Taylor rules and things like that. But do you think at this point, is there any signs you're seeing that currently sitting central bankers are beginning to understand that they've gotten that this just isn't working?
Well, I think maybe at the margin they think maybe it isn't working. My fear is that their solution to that is to do more of it until it does work. Mm-hmm. That's what I worry about. And if you, what's been fascinating post Brexit, you know, when you look at Janet Yellen and the story that she spins at every news conference is that, you know, the economy's picking up and, you know, we're on the way to where we need to be in full employment and stable inflation and, you know, the next quarter we're going to start to see things, et cetera, et cetera. And then you look across the pond in the UK at Mark Carney, who is now at the head of an establishment which didn't get what it wanted. And, you know, suddenly he is talking about, well, you know, people need to watch out, there's a possible mortgage bubble and things are going to be really bad. And I find that fascinating, that the person on the UK side of the channel, who really should be doing what Janet Yellen is doing and saying to people, look, you know, we've got this. We are behind you. We can stop this, and we can, you know, there is some backstop here. Is starting to roll out the fear card, possibly to help drive this thing somewhere. I don't know. Whereas in the US, where Janet Yellen should be warning people that, hey, you know, look, we've got a tepid recovery at best here, and people need to be prudent. No, she's going all guns blazing about how everything's going to be fine, and we're, you know, we're where we want to be. So the message is getting confused. The motives behind the message, which were coordinated very tightly up until last year, are starting to diverge. And then, you know, when you throw in the real unintended consequence of this Brexit move, which is the yen looking like it's heading to 95, and it becomes a real problem, because the Japanese have only got one thing to do, and it's more of the same. So what we may see out of Abe and Kuroda, I dread to think. But they, to your point, I think they do realize it's not working, but their solution, it's, you know, it's more cowbell, which is really worrying for me.
More cowbell. Now, well, let's turn to then that quintessential basket case of all of this. And of course, the place that does confuse me the most, which would be Japan, you know, first announcing negative rates back in January, shocking the world, apparently going to go more negative at this point in time because a little bit didn't work. So more is obviously the answer, speaking to your idea that when something doesn't work for these people, they'll just do more of it. Japan really surprised me that they have not managed, despite their best efforts, to really ruin their currency at this point in time. Is this just a function of carry trades? Do you think, are people really thinking the yen's just a tasty place to be, or is this just a math function that happens when you have the size of the speculative bets hanging out there needing to be unwound? This is the direction things go. Is that what we're seeing here? I'm totally confused by the yen doing what it's doing.
Yeah, it's baffling. I mean, but the ability for money flows to move around the world the way they do at the click of a mouse just tells you that people will move to the next place to go. And if sterling is going to be sold, well, you know, what do you buy against it? And people are now worried about the dollar. They're worried about the euro. Well, you know, what other G7 currencies do you have that you can actually take as the other side of that pair trade? And right now it's the yen. And so, you know, that's where people have gone. I do worry, and I think the day that Kuroda instituted negative interest rates is going to be a day that we look back on as a crucial part of this unwinding. Because if you look at what happened, having 10 days prior assured the world that not only was he not going to institute negative rates, but in his own words, negative rates weren't even on the table, to come back 10 days later and shock the world with a move to negative rates. Now, from the central bank playbook, that smacked of the, hey, will you shock at all? This will really surprise them, and this will get things really moving in that direction. And what happened, if you look at the charts that day, you'll see that the instant that announcement hit the tape, the yen, which was supposed to weaken considerably, went stronger, and the Nikkei, which is supposed to go stronger, fell 1,000 points in 30 minutes. Now, that was the gut reaction to a surprise from the markets. And that gut reaction told me, oh my God, they've lost control. Now, the rest of that day, once the spin came out, press conferences or what have you, they kind of rallied, both of them, the yen and the Nikkei, back to roughly where they were before that announcement got made. But if you look over the next week, the next 2 weeks rather, they've moved 16% in the opposite direction they were supposed to. And that to me was the first sign that markets were starting to get nervous that these guys are now either making up as they go along, or they're doing things which are going to have really bad outcomes. So I'm watching that really, really closely now, and I think the ball moved away from the Japanese through Brexit and back to Europe. Now, with the yen doing what it's doing in the post-Brexit moves, the ball's going to be back in Abe and Kuroda and Aso-san's court. And I think with the Japanese have a habit of very much voting for the status quo. It's quite the opposite to what we're seeing around the world. When things get panicky, the Japanese vote for the status quo. So I suspect the LDP, which is the ruling party in Japan, when the elections come up later this year, will actually end up with a stronger position as the incumbent party, and that may give them the green light to do God knows what. But whatever it is, it will be more of the same, only harder. They're not about to admit defeat and give up. And that could spell, you know, a whole new escalation in the currency war and the quantitative easing process.
Now, this is just extraordinarily fascinating to me, particularly with respect to Japan, because Japan, by the numbers, should be an easy case for investors to solve. You know, over the long term, it's the world's largest floating retirement colony. They're losing population right now. They are rapidly aging. Every sign says that Japan ought to be a case for a managed economic contraction if the economy was in service to the people. But the economy is a subset itself of supporting the financial system. And Japan, to me, just seems to be a case example, like HBR will rate these up, of how a people and a political process became enslaved to the needs of the banking system or the financial system, as it were, because they're trying to get more growth. They want more cowbell. They need growth. But it clearly, demographically, a little shrinkage might not be a bad thing over there. But if we don't have this growth, it seems to me that, you know, all my analysis, Grant, leads to this conclusion. It's what Richard Russell said a long time ago. It's either you're inflating the credit in a system or it dies. It doesn't feel like a particularly wonderful, stable system to have, but it's the one we got. How is it that Japan has gotten itself to a point where, if I have these numbers right, I was just looking at their 40-year bonds, which were by hands down one of the best investments this year, up 90-some percent this year, yielding a tasty, tasty 0.08%, if I'm reading the numbers right. I can't make any sense of that, except to understand that the Japanese government bond market is now wholly a subsidiary of their central bank, and everybody else has just sort of given up on that market being anything other than a policy tool of the central bank. I'm just confused by where this goes, except to everything ultimately being owned by the central bank, or it collapses.
Well, I did a presentation recently called Crazy, which I'm very happy to share a link to the listeners to if they want to watch it. And if you look at the numbers, you know, the unintended consequences of this move by the Bank of Japan is extraordinary. You know, they now own 52% of the ETF market in Japan, and what that's done inadvertently has meant that the Bank of Japan is now a top 10 shareholder through their ETF holdings in 90% of the companies in the Nikkei 225. And when you say things like this out loud, you kind of, you know, the whole point of this presentation was to outline gradually how crazy this has all got. And it happens incrementally, and it's the boarding frog analogy, whatever you want to call it. But when you step back and you look at how crazy this has all become, it has to end badly somewhere and somehow. But I think in Japan's case, the problem with demographic trends is they're so big and they're so long-term that people struggle to make investments around them, because, you know, you almost feel like you're going to die before they work out. But they are some of the most predictable outcomes you're ever going to find in any investment scenario. You know, the Japanese one, when I moved to Japan in 1989, I remember reading an article not long after I got there talking about how in 25 years the Japanese population was going to be net shrinking by 20,000 people a month. And you know what? Guess what happened? 25 years later, right on cue, it happened. And so these are predictable, foreseeable, investable ideas, but the time horizon on them is so long that people shy away from making them. And a lot of that is due to having to report monthly numbers. I mean, not many people will give you 25-year lock-up capital. But that's why the environment we're in now for something like a family office, for example, is a tremendous opportunity to put on long-term, sometimes intergenerational trades that you can see will end up a certain way. It's just there's going to be an awful lot of sturm and drang between now and then, and a lot of volatility that most people don't have the short-term stomach for. So, you know, where Japan ends, you know, I think we know where it ends. And coming back to Carl Bass, you know, Carl Bass's rational investor paradox is one of the great investment cases of our time. And it's been totally proven to not happen yet. Why? Well, because the Bank of Japan have done things that no one coming up with what you want to call a rational investor paradox would have ever thought they would do. But they've done it, and they've achieved a short-term aim. But every time they do it, the length that it works out for them gets shorter, and the move against them when it comes gets more violent. And so at some point, you know what's going to happen? Abe's going to step down. Kuroda's going to step down. And you know what? Next guy, okay, you go clean up the mess. And there is going to be a mess. I just don't know when it's going to happen.
Well, let's speaking of that mess, let's broaden it out a bit. I want to get your views on the dollar. So the dollar, I mean, if we view it all by itself in isolation, it's a complete disaster too, right? Its issuing country has trillions and trillions of outstanding obligations to foreigners. It runs a persistent trade deficit. Its entitlement programs are insolvent to the tune of $50 to $200 trillion, depending on whose numbers you're believing. But in a global world of competitive devaluations and even more horrible national finances in other countries, it's been a relative star performer. Could you give us your views on how you approach thinking about the dollar in today's world? And I know you gave us some by saying, you know, just look at the pair trades and where things are going. But many have predicted the demise of the dollar, but I've always wondered against what?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is gold. I think against what is gold. But in the short term, you know, I'm torn on the dollar. I mean, I speak to a lot of very smart people, and I think I ask everyone their opinion of the dollar because I think it's the key to all this. And I did an interview with Francis Scotland of Brandywine recently, and he said something to me that really stuck with me. He said, you know, if you can tell me where the dollar's going to be in a year and a half's time, I can tell you the level of pretty much every other asset. And I think he's absolutely right. As goes the dollar, so goes everything else at the moment. And I think what we have at the moment is we've had this tremendous bull market in the dollar, which, you know, my business partner, Raoul Powell, has waxed very, very eloquently about. And he's been absolutely right. But we're now at the point where the dollar wants to go up against other fiat currencies because they want to go down. But the problems of a strong dollar are now all over the world. We saw this in the last 18 months or prior to the pause. We saw it in that, you know, second half of 2014 and through 2015. The problems, the knock-on effects of a strong dollar that it has in the commodity complex, in Asia, where there's an awful lot of $9 trillion of dollar-denominated debt been taken out. The problems that it will cause are such that, you know, I think there will have to be a much earlier intervention if we do get a strongly rising dollar, which I can totally see happening as people flee from other assets. But I think it won't be allowed to run as far as it needs to before it will be capped through, you know, some kind of Plaza Accord style deal. There will have to be something done to manage that, because the ripple effects of the dollar moving 20% higher than it is now would be just devastating right around the world. Now, it can get out of control. They might want to step in and they can lose control of it to the upside, but it will necessarily be a return to coordinated central bank intervention, and they will all want to and need to intervene on the side of weakening the dollar. You know, to me, ultimately, you know, we get back to gold, and you know, I don't like harping on about it, but it seems to me that more people are coming around to this way of thinking, and Brexit seems to have solidified that. You know, the searches for buying gold were up 500% overnight in post the Brexit vote. I think more people are starting to realize, in an era of negative rates and infinitely printable fiat currencies, that whether you believe it's the solution or the answer or not is irrelevant. I think more people realize that there is a place for gold in every portfolio, and it doesn't need much more than that, as I've written about and you have in the past. It doesn't need much more than a realization that gold is a solution of sorts for some very dramatic things to happen in the gold market, based purely on this difference between the paper trading vehicles and the physical ownership of the asset. And I think we're starting to see that unwind. You know, withdrawals of physical gold in Shanghai are up 10 times since 2009. And withdrawals of physical gold on the COMEX have fallen to an all-time low. So you are seeing a very clear movement of the physical metal to countries who are familiar with currency debasement, who are familiar with the failure of currencies. And I think that squirreling away of physical gold into very strong hands that are well aware of what gold will do for you. I mean, now we have the UK, where sterling is up, I think, 23% this year. And if you look at that, if you look at what sterling did in gold through the Brexit vote, you'll see that despite the fall of the pound, the fall of the FTSE, if you had your money in gold in sterling terms, you actually made a decent profit out of Brexit. And that's not to say someone's going to buy it and flip it overnight. What that's to say is there is a clear and recent example of a Western democracy, the fifth largest economy in the world, where its citizens, had they owned some gold, were protected from a very bad outcome in the short term. And that message, I think, is going to get through to a lot of people. And you are just going to see an increase in the number of people who realize that gold is an answer to the problems created by fiat currency. And so what happens to the dollar, we've started to see the dollar and gold go up at the same time, which is another clarion call for me, because that tends to happen at moments of extreme stress. We saw that happen in 08. We saw it happen back in, you know, the 1929 through 33. When gold and the dollar start going up at the same time, you need to have all your radar up, because there is something happening.
Very well said. Now, I'm thinking back to your presentation from last year where you said about gold, the title was Nobody Cares. just brilliant. And at least in the West, nobody cares in the West. So reading between the lines here, are you saying that you're detecting that Western investors and money managers are finally waking up to gold as some sort of proper asset or hedge at this point? Or are we just still thinking that they ought to be seeing it by now?
No, I really do. I really sense that. I think the talk to come out of the likes of Stan Druckenmiller and Carl Icahn, people who have a big picture view and actually carry some weight. You know, no one's going to listen to me, but they're sure as hell going to listen to Stan Druckenmiller. But the Nobody Cares presentation, as luck would have it, because you never know when these things would happen, the timing of that was perfect. It was December last year. And since then, the gold markets went stratospheric. But the point of that was how little people need to wake up to make a material difference. And to see something a couple of months after that, where someone at PIMCO wrote an article called Rumpelstiltskin that advocated owning gold from the biggest bondholder in the world, they're the kind of signals that you need to look out for, because that tells you that the establishment is coming around to the idea of, maybe owning a little bit of gold isn't such a bad idea. And to them, 1.5-2% allocated to gold in a world of negative interest rates, there's no opportunity cost for that, realistically. Why not switch some of your cash into gold? Now, if the pension industry does that, if the pension industry en masse decides they want a 2% allocation to gold, which, as I said, is by no means a crazy thing to do, you wait and see what that does to the gold markets. If you have 2% of the pension, I forget what the number was now, but it's, it was a move to something like $100 billion of gold, of money would go into the gold markets. And that is not an amount of money that can be absorbed by the gold markets without, significantly higher prices than this. And at the end of the day, gold is not a paper contract on the COMEX. It's not an ETF. Gold is a physical commodity. And when people want it, they tend to want it for the physical nature, not for the trading nature. And so when they want it, they're going to want the metal and not the paper. And we will see people go to lengths they need to get the physical commodity. And that, I'm afraid, has to be at higher prices than this.
Well, and particularly in the case of when we speak about the average investor, I think the average investor has to be aware that they may not have access to gold if the price is spiking high enough, it will literally disappear and evaporate from the retail chain. And of course, people will still have access to it in some of the more established trading exchanges and whatnot, but those are typically going to be more well-heeled investors. I've seen tightness come into the silver market with some rapid moves in times past, and the retail channels just dry up. So it's a lot more difficult for the small investor to get their hand on the physical. And I'm sure you'd still be able to, of course, trade in and out of ETFs, but, I advise for and against those to varying degrees, depending on which ones we're talking about. But, the physical metal is obviously, I think, where people should start, and they should always have a core position. Even John Molden, when I was talking with him at a conference a year and a half ago, he was saying that he owns gold, hates it, but it's his insurance policy. And by holding gold, he means physical coins that he buys on a regular basis, not because he wants to, but because he feels he has to.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot more people coming around to that way of thinking, that saying, well, look, I'm getting negative rates in the bank, and we're fast approaching the point where the banks are literally going to send you a bill for holding your money. you know, at that point, we've seen the move to ban cash as people try to take the money out of the banking system and just keep cash in their own homes. We've seen the counter moves that are being made. We've seen the narrative around how it's only drug dealers and money launderers that use large denomination notes. Right. We've seen all that. I mean, you can see the moves on this chessboard several stages ahead, and they all lead to a tightening of the ability to own your own assets in the form you want to own them in. And so, you know, once these things happen, it's too late. People need to be aware that in 1933, if you didn't own gold before Executive Order 6102 got put in place, you couldn't buy it. And if you did own it, you were obliged to turn it in. Now, I'm sure a lot of law-abiding citizens did that, but at the time, in times of stress like that, I'm sure just as many buried it in the back garden. And waited until that was removed. But that was by government decree. Gold went up 20% the next day. You know, the government revalued it on you. So this is what happens. And gold is not just the answer to a certain set of problems that face an individual investor. You know, gold is a potential answer to a lot of the problems facing central banks in terms of where they value the gold on their books. You know, if that gold was valued at $10,000 an ounce, suddenly all these central banks look a hell of a lot more solvent. The question is, can you afford for that revaluation to take place? And the answer, of course, right now is no. But does that have to happen at some point to deal with the debt? Very possibly. You know, we are in a world of unthinkable outcomes just a short time ago. And so people need to broaden their horizons and understand that things they thought absolutely impossible. I mean, take it down to President Donald Trump. I mean, a year ago even, that would have got you laughed out of any bar in America. And now he's a one in two shot to get that job. So these outcomes are unthinkable until they are staring you in the face. And as I said, you need to have a plan. And that plan needs to at least involve thinking through outcomes that are wildly, wildly unbelievable at the time, but you need to have a plan for it.
Now, I'm going to turn now in our final segment here to perhaps the most unthinkable outcome of them all, and the one that I don't like to turn to, but I've written about it, you've spoken and written about it, war. You know, you and I, before we started recording, were talking about your presentation from a year ago or more, I think, where you made the case that the elements that we saw that were sort of in place during World War I, there's a remarkable set of similarities to where we are today. And as somebody who's done my best to try and understand World War I and its causes, I finally threw up my hands and came to the conclusion that it was just a whole lot of tinder piled about waiting for a spark. And so we have some of that happening now, it feels like. And perhaps some of the signs, you just spoke to some of the signposts. You have a presidential candidate Trump could be a signpost, or Brexit could be a signpost. Lots of signs of stress out there in the system. So your views on this, I know you've mentioned this. I am of a mind, and I've particularly written about my favored flashpoint, which is the degree to which NATO, particularly U.S. specifically, seems to be bent on antagonizing Russia for reasons that are entirely mysterious to me. But there you have it. So your views on the chance of war and where you might see the greatest risk for adversaries tangling up?
I think the greatest risk when you talk about war is always a misstep, a policy misstep, a policy mistake, or something coming out of a clear blue sky. You know, in 1914, it was Gavrilo Princip shooting Archduke Ferdinand because his car took a wrong turn. I mean, you just don't know how these things are going to play out. But I certainly think when you talk about war, it's something that people assume just is finished. We're not going to have another great conflict. And I'm sure that in 1919, everybody thought the same thing. And in 1945, everybody thought the same thing. And great moves were made to try and stop it happening again. But human beings have a habit of making mistakes, and leaders have a habit of getting over their skis and puffing their chests out too far and saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. And as I said, in the case of 1914, people have a habit of doing things that you don't see coming. So these things happen. And whatever the risk is of war, it's a tough thing to talk about without people assuming that you're just saying, well, this idiot's saying there's going to be another world war. It's absolutely not what I'm saying. I know it's not what you're saying, but I think the point we're both trying to make here is whatever the percentage chance of there being a war is, it's not zero. And so, again, it's perhaps the most extreme outcome. But you have to understand that these things can happen. And if you do go back to 1914 and you look at the parallels, and again, I'm happy to give you a link to that presentation because they're all there. It's remarkable how similar it was. And you know, Santayana said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. If you're a student of history, you see this happen time and time and time again. And amazingly, what tends to be very prevalent in the build-up to these conflicts is a strong build-up in indebtedness around the world in countries. And here we are again. You know, war is a great way to wipe out debts. Back in the 1900s and the 1939, 1945 conflict, wars were incredibly capital-intensive, human capital-intensive, mechanical operations. What they'll look like in the 21st century, we don't really know. I mean, we've seen regional wars, we've seen conflict in the Middle East. We've seen what that looks like. We haven't seen a widespread conflict and how much of that would be through cyberspace and cyber warfare. And you like to think, if you embrace the idea that it's a possibility, you like to think that at least the one comforting factor would be that it would not involve hundreds of thousands of young lives being lost, but instead would be countries being brought to heel by attacks on their, you know, computer networks and internet and power grids. And, you know, we're seeing all this go on. I've interviewed security specialists for Real Vision that talk about the constant probing and attacks from Russian hackers or Chinese, whoever they may be, adversaries. And I think you'd be naive to assume that US and NATO hackers aren't probing for weaknesses in the defense systems and the infrastructure of Russia and China. I mean, it would be just naive to think that. So you know, I don't know what this looks like. I don't know what the outcome is, and I don't know that it will happen. But I know that there's no one in this world that can say with absolute certainty that it won't happen. And so, again, I keep coming back to this idea that you need to think through really, really wide-tail outcomes and think to yourself, what would it mean? What do I need to do? And what percentage chance do I ascribe to this happening? And you know, I know that it's not zero. And so, do you need to have a plan when it gets to 5%? Maybe that's the way you look at it. And as long as the chance of a war happening is less than 5%, it's not something you need to take into account. I totally understand that. But these things have a habit of going from 5% to 20% real fast. And you definitely need to have a plan when it's at 20%. So doing the thinking early in any of these situations is just worth doing, is all I'm saying. And you know, I hope cooler heads will prevail. I hope we don't see an escalation in the number of military encounters that the US and China are having in the South China Seas. And Dr. Pippa Malmgren is all over this. She's done some fantastic writing on this and is really alert to the increasing engagement between US and Russian and US and Chinese troops in the South China Sea. You know, it's happening. It's a real problem. And you just hope that nobody makes one of those mistakes that do happen from time to time in world history and change the course of events.
Very well said. And that's always been my concern, is that when you have a bunch of naval assets in a bathtub like the Persian Gulf, there's a chance for something to happen. And by the time you can cool things down, maybe you've got a kinetic war on your hands. And as I've written about, that the cyber war actually concerns me more. For its potential impact. And we know, you know, Symantec came out, I think, a year and a half ago and said, oh, hey, we found all this rootkit malware in the admin levels of our pipelines and our electrical grid operators. Hey, that's not good, right? So we know that both sides are busy, you know, inserting malware into the core operating machinery of our lives. So that's just something people need to think about. So, of course, a small chance of something happening combined with a catastrophic outcome multiplies into something that a prudent person might say, I should do some thinking around that. It's just insurance, right? So that to me feels just logical and rational, but I'm astonished, Grant, at how many people won't go there, won't think that, won't entertain that. It's just too belief shattering. So they won't otherwise go there. But it feels to me like it's really time for prudent people to at least ask what if, and even if the outcome of that is to dismiss it, that's totally fine. I'm good with that. What I'm not good with is not even starting the conversation to get to the dismissal point.
Look, I think, Chris, if you live in a world where you can have a negative interest rate, if you can have negative interest rates, then you have to entertain all kinds of outcomes. Because if anyone had said in 1980, when U.S. rates were 15%, that there was going to be a time when, you know, other countries in the world would be you know, penalizing people, I mean, people would have thought you were insane. And of course, it is insane. It is insane to pay governments to for the benefit of lending them money. But hey, look, here we are. So, you know, you need to work out what you think is a more unlikely outcome. And given the number of wars that have happened in human history, you compare that with the number of times when there's been a negative interest rate environment, I know which one I think is the far more less likely outcome. And we're sitting in the middle of it.
Yeah, well said. And I confess, I still don't understand negative interest rates. I mean, yeah, I understand how they destroy pensions and push people out the risk curve for equities. But in terms of all the rest of the impacts, I have no clue what's coming next. And I'm prepared for many unintended consequences on that front, because they just warp hundreds of years of established thinking, investing ideas. We just don't know yet, I don't think. But we've got central bankers who are convinced it's the right way to go. So, well, that's where we are.
You and I started this conversation talking about Brexit. And if you look at who voted to leave the EU, and referring back to my point about the referendum is really always a vote on your state of life rather than the question being asked, you know, who voted in their droves to leave? Well, you know what? It's the guys on pensions. It was the older demographic that all came out and voted to leave because they've all retired thinking, great, I've worked my entire life for this. And now they find that their pensions aren't performing. They can't make any money. They can't afford to live. Yeah, that's what's happening. And that's the unintended consequence of what these guys are doing. And I'm sure they didn't think they'd be doing it for this long, but here we are. And so the voting demographic, you know, middle-aged and old people, are voting against them in their droves. And it's not going to change, I'm afraid.
Well, fantastically well said, and I thoroughly agree with that. So we've come to the end of our time, unfortunately. I could talk with you for hours, of course. Thank you so much for being with us, Grant, today. And tell our listeners where they can subscribe to your must-read newsletter.
Sure. The newsletter is at www.ttmygh.com. That's things that make you go, .com. And also Real Vision. I mean, www.realvisiontv.com. There's some fascinating interviews on there with a bunch of really, really smart people. You know, Chris, I mean, this is what you do so well on the podcast. Just sit these people down and give them the time to talk, and you'd be amazed what you can learn from talking to successful, smart people.
Absolutely. And any particular interviews coming up you're excited about?
There's a ton of stuff coming. We just published a great piece with Kyle Bass. I was at a very exclusive family office gathering in Montreal recently and interviewed a bunch of people. And, you know, the interesting thing is it's the people you've never heard of that will really blow people's minds, because you don't get a chance to hear from these guys. And they are, you know, every bit as brilliant as the household names, but the sort of mainstream media channels won't go to find them. And so to sit and talk to demographers and, you know, political terrorism experts about what they do and how they see the world is just a fascinating process.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I can't wait to watch those as well. And again, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, anytime. It's always a thrill. Thank you.